There's nothing I can do about it. My hands are tied. This last was said quickly, without pause, almost as though he feared her reaction and was trying to stave off a return assault. Maureen sat there, stunned. She was tempted to argue with him, to point out that such a policy was discriminatory and probably illegal, but she understood the feelings of the people in town, and to a large extent shared them herself. She thought of the gate, thought of Ray, thought of all the reasons she and Barry distrusted the Homeowners Association, and she could not fault the people of Corbin for hating and fearing Bonita Vista.
"I know you're caught in the middle of this," Harlan repeated. "And like I said, this really has nothing to do with you."
Maureen stood, nodded tiredly.
"I understand."
"We'll pay you your kill fee."
"I understand."
Back at home, she checked her email, scrolling down to view the list of messages she'd received that morning. The subject headings were all over the map, but though the specific names were different, the substance of each was the same. All of her local clients had dropped her. It was not totally unexpected, not after what had happened at the title company, but it was still overwhelming to see it laid out like this, to witness in cold, flat type such complete rejection. She didn't even have Frank and Audrey anymore. She would have laughed if it wasn't so sad, would have cried if it wasn't so infuriating. But instead, she just sat there blankly staring at her screen. He hadn't eaten at the coffee shop for over a week. Barry told himself that it wasn't intentional, that he wasn't avoiding the place, that he'd simply had errands to run and leftovers to get rid of, and that a legitimate series of circumstances had led to him eating at home or in his office or even skipping lunch entirely. But he knew that wasn't the truth. Today, though, he was determined to return. Things had to have cooled off since last time, and he doubted that there'd be the same tension. There was no way Hank could stay angry for this long. Joe, maybe, or Lyle. But Hank was more reasonable, more sensible. And since he was their ringleader, Barry knew that the old man would exert a tempering influence and calm everyone down, remind them that Barry was on their side and was one of the good guys. But he was wrong. He sensed it the second he walked through the door. A coldness that had nothing to do with the air conditioning hit him the instant he stepped into the coffee shop, and he didn't need to look around to know that all eyes were upon him. The only noise was the muted sizzling of the grill back in the kitchen and the plinking of fork on plate as someone at one of the tables continued eating. He walked self-consciously over to his usual table and sat down, trying not to notice the complete lack of conversation, the air of hostility that overhung the eatery. Lurleen looked over at her father first, getting his okay before angrily slamming down a menu and a glass of water. The water splashed over the table and onto Barry's lap, but he forced himself to smile and keep his voice calm as he picked up the menu and handed it back to the waitress. "I don't need this, Lurleen. I'll just have the usual." She grabbed the laminated menu from his hand and stormed off without saying a word. Something had happened since the last time he'd been here. He had no idea what it was, but it had to have been big to engender this kind of anger, and he only wished he knew so he could fight against it. He used his napkin to wipe up the spilled water and took a sip from the half-filled glass. He was thinking about approaching Hank, just walking over to the old man's table, coming right out and asking what was the matter, when Joe stood up from his place near the counter and strode purposefully over to Barry's table. Barry wasn't sure how to react, so he just remained where he was, took another sip of water, and watched the other man coming. Joe faced him squarely.
"Didn't think you'd have the nerve to show your face in here."
There was anger in his voice. No, not just anger. Rage. Barry's heart was pounding. He could not remember the last time he'd gotten into any sort of physical altercation, but he had the feeling that Joe was going to try and goad him into one right here, right now, although he still had no idea why. He stood, but tried to remain relaxed and friendly, though that was getting increasingly hard to do.
"I don't know what you're talking about, Joe. Whatever's happened..."
He spread his hands in a gesture of innocence.
"I'm out of the loop. You're going to have to clue me in." Weston Richards, Joe said, practically spitting out the name. The man stared at him for a long moment, and Barry shook his head, still unaware of the intended meaning. I don't know what this Weston's done, he said, but
Weston didn't do nothing,
Lyle shouted from his table near the door.
He was killed. You guys poisoned him.
Barry looked toward Hank. There was another accident?
This weren't no accident, Hank said,
and Barry could see the fury in the old man's eyes.
They killed that boy on purpose. The Richardses didn't have no dog. And his head was bashed in.
Lurleen glared at him. There was a sinking feeling in the pit of Barry's stomach.
I don't know anything about this. This is the first I've heard about it.
Hank nodded.
That's the problem. No one knows anything about it. But we know who's responsible, Ralph said from his seat at Lyle's table.
Look, Barry tried to be reasonable. I hate that stupid homeowners association as much as you do. More probably because I have to put up with their shit and abide by their damn rules.
But you're still a part of it, Lyle pointed out. You're still a member.
I have no choice. If I live there, I have to pay dues.
You have a snow plow,
a woman near the window shouted. Barry looked over at her. She was someone he had not seen before, an overweight woman with an overbite and two large breasts, and he didn't understand either her reference to the snowplow or the anger he saw in her eyes.
What?
He asked her.
In the winter, you have a snowplow up there, but it's only for Bonita Vista. Our plow broke down last year, and we were snowed in for nearly a week. Snowed in. But you wouldn't help us, wouldn't let us use your plow, wouldn't clear off any of our roads.
What about the water? Ralph said quietly. There were nods all around. Look, I wasn't even living here last winter. I'm not involved with the water. I have nothing to do with this Weston thing.
Our utility rates went up in town because of all the electricity you use.
The runoff from your carved-up hills is contaminating the creek.
I just live there, Barry said defensively.
Weston's head was bashed in, Lurleen repeated. He was poisoned and frothing at the mouth, and the top of his head was bashed in. I knew that little boy.
I didn't do it, Barry said.
No,
Hank said, and his voice was loud enough and grave enough to silence all the others.
But you didn't do nothing to stop it, neither.
They stared at each other, and Barry realized that there was no way he was going to ever win here. No way he was going to change any opinions or convince anyone that he should not be tarred with the same brush as his neighbors.
They're trying to kill off our kids, the woman near the window said. They're mad that we won't go along with their plans, and now they're trying to kill off our kids.
Joe's voice was seething.
Pets, kids, who knows what's next?
Barry wanted to be able to argue with this, wanted to be able to fight back, but he couldn't. Such an idea might seem ludicrous, but he couldn't dismiss it out of hand, and there was no way he would stoop to defending the homeowners association.
I think you'd best get your food to go,
Bert said to him from behind the counter, and it was clear from his tone of voice that this was an order, not a suggestion. Barry's eyes focused on the small white sign propped up on top of the cash register. We reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. He had the feeling that this was going to be the last meal he would ever order from this place, or be allowed to order. He stood, finished off the last of his water, and walked over to the cash register. He would not be surprised if Bert kicked him out of the office as well, and if the sentiment of the coffee shop regulars was any indication of the local attitude toward Bonita Vista, he doubted he'd be able to find another office very soon. With the association banning him from writing in his own house, it'd be the old rock and a hard place dilemma. Maybe he'd just stake out a campsite in the forest, get himself a generator to power the computer, and write out there. With a frown, Bert handed him the greasy bag of food and took his money, silently proffering change. Barry did not look at anyone as he walked straight through the center of the coffee shop to the door. His footsteps sounded embarrassingly loud in the stillness. Once outside, he breathed a little easier. The claustrophobic tension that had been pressing in on him dissipated in the open air, and he walked back to his office across the open field, feeling as though he'd awakened from a paranoid dream and was back in the real world. 15 minutes later, he had finished his lunch, abandoned the real world, and was in the realm of death and supernatural horror, the unpleasantness at the coffee shop pushed to the back of his brain, existing for the moment only as a possible element he could add to his new novel. He was in the middle of a monster POV chapter, flying along, his fingers barely able to keep up with his mind, when the silence of the office was suddenly shattered by the crash of glass. A baseball flew through the window next to his desk, sending shards flying inward, and Barry instinctively ducked. It could have been kids, a foul ball hit in the wrong direction during a pickup game, but somehow he knew that it wasn't. When there was no follow-up, he quickly sprang to his feet and sprinted the 3 steps to the front of the office. He yanked open the door, saw a man running across the field back toward the coffee shop, but could not tell who it was. Was this merely a warning, he wondered, or the beginning of regular organized attacks against him? He didn't know, but neither possibility was promising, and he backed up his files on diskette and took the diskette with him as he locked up the office. It was nearly midnight, and they lay in bed, not speaking, listening to the soft murmur of the television.
"Maybe we should move," Maureen said softly.
"No." Barry could feel the resolve stiffening within him as he spoke. "I'm not giving those bastards the satisfaction." She answered in an exaggerated Western drawl,
"No one's gonna run us out of town before sundown."
"That's right."
"But it's cutting off your nose to spite your face. No one in town will hire me. I'm not exaggerating. No one."
"We don't need these assholes. I'm making enough for us to live comfortably."
"Yes, but I have a career too, and I don't want to give it up for some stubborn, misguided pissing contest you feel you have to win."
"What about your old clients from California?"
"There are a few," she admitted, "but that's not the point. If we were back in California, I could triple that number."
"You have your e-accounting empire."
"I could do that better in California, too."
"I don't want to turn tail and run. And I resent being blamed for something we had no part of."
"We're getting in on all sides, from the association and the association's enemies. I don't see any reason for us to stay."
"Because we like our house. Because we like the area. The reasons to stay are the same reasons we moved here in the first place. Nothing's changed. So we have a few less friends. Big deal."
Maureen sighed. "If we'd bought property in town instead of up here, none of this would be happening."
"We wouldn't have bought property in town," he said. "Ray was right. We're only here because we like the view and the paved streets and the nice homes. We wanted to live in a sanitized movie version of rural America, and now we're paying the price." He looked at her. "Can you honestly say you'd be happy living in a trailer or one of those rundown shacks that the townies live in?"
"We could have built our own house."
"And lived down there with the rednecks and the wife beaters staring up at Bonita Vista?" He shook his head.
"So it's a class thing, huh?"
"Yeah," he said. "I guess it is. No one likes to talk about that anymore. We all pretend it doesn't exist, but it does. There's a gulf. We're educated and fairly well off, and these are people who graduated from high school at best and have probably never even left the state. We're not like them, and we wouldn't fit in." He thought of the day he'd invited the guys from the coffee shop up here, and it scared him that his attitude toward them seemed to coincide with that of the association.
"We don't fit in here either," she said.
He smiled at her sweetly and batted his eyelashes.
"But we have each other."
Maureen was silent for a moment.
"I'm not putting up with this forever," she told him. "You can write anywhere, a house in California or an apartment in New York, as well as here. But I don't work on my own. I'm an accountant. I need people for my business. I'll see what I can do with conference calls and faxes and emails, but I'm not promising anything. If I start going stir crazy, we're out of here. We're gone." She was wrong, though. He couldn't write anywhere. He was not allowed to write in Bonita Vista, and there was a good likelihood he would soon be evicted from his little teapot museum office. That would be cutting off his nose to spite his face. But, to throw another cliché into the mix, he'd cross that bridge when he came to it. Neither of them said any more after that. Maureen scooted down on her pillow, put her arm around his midsection, snuggled next to him, and they both fell asleep listening to the quiet, comforting murmur of the television. 35.
Barry?
He opened his eyes groggily.
Barry?
There was a hint of panic, a touch of fear in Maureen's voice that drove away the sleepiness and caused him to sit up instantly, wide awake. The sun was streaming through a part in the curtains, and when he looked at the clock, he saw that it was after 9. He'd been asleep nearly 12 hours. He glanced over to see Maureen standing by the side of the bed, holding up a copy of the Corbin Weekly Standard. Her hands were shaking, and the rustle of the newspaper sounded strangely amplified in the silent house. He was filled with a sense of dread, and he reached out and took the paper from her, reading the banner headline, "Child Poisoned, Bonita Vista Blamed."
"It says there's going to be a rally tonight. The people of Corbin, the parents of Corbin, are planning to meet outside the gates of Bonita Vista at 8 to protest the poisonings."
Barry read through the article. The rally was being organized by Claude Richards, the father of Weston, and it was his goal to intimidate the guilty parties within Bonita Vista, the people who had made the decision to lay out the poison and the people who had actually done the deed, into giving themselves up. He wanted to put pressure on the Homeowners Association and all of the residents, a tactic that each of the individuals quoted in the article, as well as the newspaper itself, seemed to support wholeheartedly. Surprisingly, there was no quote from the sheriff, and Barry wondered where Hitman would stand on this, whose side he would take. No matter how great his loyalty to Bonita Vista, no matter how much he was being paid off, there was no way he could turn a blind eye to a killing, not of a child, not in a small town, not if he wanted to keep his job. "I don't like the sound of this rally," he said, handing back the paper.
"Me either.
I see a bunch of drunk bubbas bringing their shotguns and talking themselves into mob violence."
"There's nothing scarier than groupthink," Barry agreed.
"So what should we do?"
"What can we do?"
Maureen sat down on the bed next to him.
"I thought we could take a trip.
There's probably more national parks within driving distance of this place than anywhere else in the country, and we haven't been to any of them.
Why don't we drive out, find some place to stay in Cedar City, and go to Bryce or Zion or Cedar Breaks?"
"You've really been thinking about this."
"I've been looking through our AAA book," she admitted. She took his hand.
"I don't want to be here tonight. I have a bad feeling about it."
He leaned over and gave her a quick kiss.
"I'm serious. There's the potential for danger here."
"From which side?"
"I don't know. It doesn't matter. I just don't want to be here when it happens."
Barry sighed.
"I don't think anything will happen."
"How can you say that?
We have a gate with an armed guard. And even Hitman can't ignore something like this. The sheriff will make sure things don't get out of hand."
Maureen laughed shortly.
"Right."
He was about to argue that their home was far enough up the hill that even if the Corbin protesters got through the gate and went on some kind of rampage, the mob would probably be stopped or spent by the time they reached their place.
Rampage.
But he stopped himself.
What the hell was he doing? What was he thinking?
After everything he'd seen, after everything he knew or suspected, was he honestly arguing for the probability of normalcy reasserting itself? This wasn't a normal situation. This wasn't a normal place. Normal logic did not apply. Shit, if he didn't know better, he'd think that he'd been influenced or corrupted, bombarded with association mind rays or magical spells to make him more complacent and compliant and agreeable to the party line.
"You're right," Barry admitted.
"So we'll go?"
"Yeah," he said. "After breakfast, after I take a shower. Just pack enough for overnight, though.
We're coming back tomorrow. To survey the damage? Hopefully not. She kissed him. You're a good man, Charlie Brown. She stood up. Go take your shower. Want to join me? Tonight, she promised. Barry had finished his shower and was up in the kitchen pouring himself some coffee when he heard a loud knock at the front door. Maureen, already downstairs, answered it and a moment later called his name. He moved around the corner and looked over the railing to see Mike enter the living room, newspaper in hand. Hey, Barry called, walking downstairs. How's it going? Mike held up a copy of the Standard. I assume you saw this? Barry nodded. They're calling it a rally, Mike said angrily, trying to make it sound like some sort of happy high school thing. It's a planned assault is what it is, an attack on us. They want to get enough people together so that they can storm the gates and I don't know what. That's why we're leaving, Barry said. Mo wants us to spend the night in Cedar City just in case things get too hairy. I don't... Mike shook his head, confused. What are you talking about? I have a bad feeling about this, Maureen said. I don't claim to be psychic or anything, but I just think we need to get out of here. Something's wrong. Something's going to happen. Yeah, something's going to happen. They're going to vandalize our property. He'll come back to smash windows and shot up car tires and who knows what all. Exactly. That's why we don't want to be here when it happens. Mike turned toward Barry. What's the matter with you? He asked. This is your home. This is your property. You can't tell me you wouldn't stay and fight a fire to save your house. Hell, we'd all be up on our roofs with hoses, wetting down everything in sight. Barry nodded reluctantly. Same thing here. I know the association is fucked up, but we have no choice but to back them on this. Besides, this is what the association is supposed to be doing. Protecting Bonita Vista, standing up for the residents. There wouldn't even be this rally if the association hadn't... He looked into Mike's eyes. If those kids hadn't been poisoned. It's a deal with the devil, Mike admitted. But we have no choice. Whether we like it or not, those Corbinites see this as an us-versus-them situation, and we're them. Barry tried to smile. What do you think they'll do? Burn down our houses? Vigilante justice is not exactly unheard of in this part of the world, and yes, that is something I think they might try to do. Me too, Maureen said. That's why I don't want to be here. You can't fight a mob. You can't reason with a horde of angry, stirred-up people, particularly ones whose children have been killed. I understand your feelings, Mike said to her. He turned to Barry. But why are you going? Because you fear for your personal safety? That's okay if it is. That's a legitimate reason. But if you're doing this to get back at the association, because you think it'll somehow hurt them, then you're wrong. You read that article. They blame us, all of us, not just the association. And I don't think the rest of us should suffer collateral damage because of it. It was the fire analogy that had gotten to him. As much as Barry hated to admit it, as much as he wanted to stick with Maureen and the promise he'd made to her, Mike's argument made sense. He should stay with his house, make sure his home was safe. It was his duty. And there was something else. We can't leave, he told her. Not this macho bullshit. Who's going to protect our house? What, you're going to buy a gun and sit on the porch to shoot at intruders? Come on, this is craziness. If there is any damage, our homeowner's insurance will cover it. Half the homes here are unoccupied. They're vacation homes. What about those people? They're not rushing back for the last stand at the OK Corral. She looked into his eyes. There's no reason to do this. What if it's a test? He said quietly. What? What if the association just wants to know who's willing to stay and fight? Fight? She practically screamed. Figuratively, not literally. What if they're just trying to gauge the mettle of their opponents? Us. I'll let you two discuss it, Mike said, backing off toward the door. I think you should stay, though. There's strength in numbers, and we need all the bodies we can get. Like she said, there aren't a lot of full-timers up here, and we don't have a newspaper recruiting people for our side like they do. He stepped outside and carefully closed the screen. It's something to think about. She slammed the door behind him. It's not something to think about. Mo, you promised me we'd leave.
I know.
What is this? The great iconoclastic horror writer Barry Welch is afraid of what his neighbors will say about him? Fuck them! If you want to show someone that you have balls, show me, your wife, and stand down this peer pressure and get the hell out of here for the night. That was the problem with being a writer, Barry thought. He could see things from both sides. It was his job to get into characters' heads, to articulate the thought processes behind opposing points of view. Maureen was right, but Mike was right too. He spent each day engaging in such schizophrenic empathy, and it was why he was always aware of the duality in any given situation. But he'd never seen things from the association's side. That was true. And that was why his logic broke down when it came to the Homeowners Association. It was still not inconceivable to him that the association wanted him to agonize over this choice, that they were behind this entire scenario, and had placed him in this position in order to observe him and study his reaction, like scientists examining the behavior of a lab rat. Such Byzantine deviousness might seem absurd, the product of an overactive imagination, but when all of the events since their arrival here were viewed as part of a continuum, it was a conclusion that did not seem at all far-fetched. What if this is all part of some elaborate scheme on the part of the association? He asked. I'm serious about this. What if it is a test? Now you are being paranoid. Get real. They poisoned pets and children because they knew it would get the populace up in arms and they'd descend on Bonita Vista with baseball bats and guns, and then Barry Welch would be forced to decide whether or not to remain home for the evening? You don't think that's being just a little egocentric and self-absorbed? He grimaced. Well, when you put it that way, it's about time you came to your senses. Now let's get out of here before some other version of Satan tries to tempt you away from the path. Mike's Satan? Just get ready to go. Barry nodded. Okay. He happened to glance over at the television. Wait a minute. Let's check out the Weather Channel, see what the weather's going to be like. He picked up the remote from the coffee table and started flipping through channels, trying to find the station. Hey, Maureen said. What's that? What? Flip it back a few. He pressed the down button and the channels reversed. There! Barry frowned. What was this, some kind of community access station? A fuzzy, nearly colorless videotape of a tennis match, seen from above, was being broadcast. There was no sound, only the bird's-eye view of an elderly couple in matching whites stumblingly attempting to dash about the court despite an obvious lack of athletic ability. That's the tennis court, Maureen pointed. Our tennis court. She picked up the list of cable channels from the top of the television. 16, she said, her finger running down the station lineup. BVTV. She frowned. BVTV? What's... But the expression on her face said that she'd already figured it out. Bonita Vista Television. Barry stared at the match on screen. So that's what that camera's for. He looked triumphantly at Maureen. I knew it wasn't just security. My God. They watched the man awkwardly try but fail to return the woman's serves. I've seen those two before, Maureen said. I think they live down by Audrey. What else do you think they're taping? Barry asked quietly. As if in answer to his question, the scene shifted. Now it was a live video feed from inside someone's house, the camera focused on the movements of a lone woman. Liz. She was not doing anything, merely sitting on the white living room couch, hands in her lap, head looking up, sobbing, but the scene was so intimate, so invasive, that Barry immediately shut off the television. He could not watch. After only those few seconds of unsolicited voyeurism, he felt dirty and guilty. It was uncomfortable to see a person in so private a moment. He wondered if the board members were watching on their own televisions, and if they were smiling. The thought filled him with white-hot rage, a righteous anger. He had never hated the Homeowners Association more than he did at that moment. He thought of that weasel Neil Campbell, of the prissy seriousness of that unrepentant toady, and he realized that to him, Campbell was the face of the association because he had never actually seen a member of the board. He'd seen Jasper Calhoun's car and his house, but he'd never seen Calhoun himself, and he'd never seen any of the others either. Hell, he didn't even know their names. A tear snaked down Maureen's cheek, and she drew in a ragged breath. How could they do something like this? Liz told you the board was after her. I'm going to call, let her know about this. Maureen ran upstairs, picked up the phone from the dining room table where they'd left it, and punched in Liz's number as she walked back down the steps. It obviously took several rings for Liz to answer because Maureen was at the bottom of the steps before she started talking, and Barry imagined the old woman pulling herself together, wiping the tears from her face, breathing deeply before picking up the phone, and doing it all on camera for the amusement of her neighbors. You're on BVTV right now, Maureen said. There's some kind of hidden camera in your house. We turned on the TV and saw you sitting on the couch, crying. There's no sound, so we can talk, but get away from the couch. Get away from the living room. They can see you. There was a long pause as Maureen listened to her friend. Uh-huh. Yeah. No. No. I understand. Yes, we are. Same to you. Bye. Maureen hung up the phone, looking stunned. She says she knows. She knows? She saw herself on TV last night. Maureen's jaw tightened. Going to the bathroom. But how? It's not live. It's edited on tape. She wasn't crying just now. She said that was probably taken last week sometime. She was in the kitchen cleaning. She was up half the night trying to find where the camera in the bathroom was hidden, but couldn't find a thing. Now she thinks her whole house is probably under surveillance. What's she going to do? File a complaint? That's it? Keep looking for the cameras, I guess. And try to ignore them until she does. Jesus. Let's get out of here, Maureen said. Let's go to Cedar City. 10 minutes later, their bags were in the Suburban and they were ready to go. Maureen looked back at the house. Do you think we should board up the windows first, just in case? Barry shook his head. I don't want to show fear. I don't want the association to think we scare easily. As far as they're concerned, we just decided to take a little trip for a few days because we wanted to see the country.
Okay.
Besides, we'd have to go down to the lumber yard, buy some plywood, nail it up. I don't know how I'd reach those top windows. I said okay. Okay. They got into the SUV and Barry pulled out of the driveway onto the road. They were stopped at the gate. I'm sorry, the guard said, walking out of the kiosk. No one is allowed to enter or leave Bonita Vista. He was wearing an expression of grim determination. The olive garb was gone, replaced by a crisp black uniform, the shirt adorned with silver epaulets and insignias, feet clad in knee-high black boots. His usual clipboard was nowhere in evidence, and his right hand rested on the holstered pistol at his side.
What? Barry said.
You may not leave Bonita Vista. It's been deemed a security risk, and I'm afraid that for your own safety, you are not allowed to depart the premises.
What the fuck is this? The association's declaring martial law?
The guard met his gaze. Exactly. He'd meant it as a joke. Well, not a joke exactly, but a cutting barb, an exaggeration intended to embarrass the guard and draw attention to the absurdity of such a situation. Instead, he was confronted with a flat acknowledgement that his sarcastic overstatement was the truth. He looked over at Maureen in the passenger seat. Her face was red, livid with anger, and she leaned around him to address the guard.
"Listen, you. We are the Homeowners Association, and you work for us. Our dues pay your salary. Now open that goddamn gate and let us through."
The guard looked at her coldly, then turned his attention to Barry. "I suggest you back up and turn this vehicle around."
"What is your name?" Maureen demanded. "I'll have your job, you insolent son of a bitch!"
"My name is Curtis, and as you know, I also live in Bonita Vista." He leaned forward, resting an arm on the open window frame of the Suburban, letting the tip of his face cross over the invisible boundary that separated the inside of the vehicle from the outside. "And I'd appreciate a little respect from you, you insolent cunt." He smiled, pulled away, tipped the black cap that covered his blonde brush cut. "Good day, ma'am, sir." Barry put the transmission into reverse and backed up the way they'd come. At the tennis court, he swung into the small parking lot, turned around, and headed up the hill.
"We're trapped," Maureen said incredulously. "We're trapped here, and we can't escape."
"Let me think," Barry told her. "We'll go back home for a minute and try to figure something out."
"There's nothing to figure out.
I suppose we could walk out of here, but it's a half-hour hike to town, and that's the only place we could get to. Besides, that would be going into the lion's den." He smiled. "We could pull a C.W. McCall."
"Huh?"
"Crash the gate doing 98?
"Don't think it's not tempting."
Barry pulled into the driveway, turned off the ignition. "He had a gun. Did you notice that?"
"Yes,"
she said quietly. They sat in silence for a moment. "So what do we do?" Barry asked. "Do you have any ideas?"
"No."
She sighed.
"God, I can't believe this is happening."
"Let's go inside. Maybe we'll think of something." They got out of the Suburban, walked around the Toyota, but even before they'd started up the porch steps, they saw a notice on the screen door. They'd been gone 5 minutes, 8 at the most, but somehow someone had managed to come onto their property and leave a message from the Homeowners Association.
"Are we under surveillance?" Maureen asked. "Do they spy on us and wait until we leave so they can rush in and put this crap on our door? This can't be coincidence."
"Nothing's coincidence." He remembered the note they'd found in the closet. "They're doing it. They're keeping track of it. Don't think they aren't." Barry freed the paper from the grating and read it. "It's an order for all residents to attend the Bonita Vista anti-rally at 8 o'clock tonight."
"Order?"
"That's what it says." He handed her the notice, then used his key to unlock the door. They walked inside.
"According to this, they'll fine us if we don't show up. Is that legal?"
"I don't know. I have a feeling that it is, though. That's one thing they don't seem to screw up on. However outrageous their actions, they always seem to come down on this side of the law." "According to Sheriff Hitman, not exactly an unimpeachable source in my mind." "I'll call Jeremy. He'll be able to tell us." He locked the door behind them, through the deadbolt. Barry went downstairs and dialed Jeremy's number, but midway through the first ring, a robotic female voice came on the line and said,
"I'm sorry. Due to a heavy call volume, all circuits are busy. Please try again."
The call was cut off, leaving only a dial tone. He tried again. And again. And again, and again, and again. Over an hour period, he must have dialed Jeremy's number 30 times, but in each instance he received the same recorded message. He finally gave up, throwing the phone across the room in frustration. It bounced harmlessly on the carpet. Not only couldn't they leave, but they could not contact the outside world. They were cut off here, effectively isolated, and he could not help thinking that it was entirely intentional, that it was part of the association's goal. He would not be surprised to learn that Bonita Vista had its own switchboard, and that all incoming and outgoing calls were routed through there, giving the association the power to censor and monitor all of its residents' phone messages. Neither he nor Maureen could think of any way to get past the armed guard save the convoy option, and they soon tired of staring at each other across the living room as they fruitlessly tried to brainstorm. Maureen finally went downstairs to work on her webpage while Barry headed upstairs to make himself an early lunch. Mike called just after noon.
Did you get the notice?
You're the one who left that for me?
No, I got one too. I was just wondering what your plans are.
I don't know yet.
They can level a fine against you, and if you don't pay it, they can put a lien on your house.
I'm so glad we live in a democracy.
We live in a gated community, Mike corrected him. The two are mutually exclusive.
What are you going to do?
Go.
Me too, I suppose.
I've got an extra baseball bat if you want one, Mike said.
Baseball bat? Barry felt an unfamiliar shudder pass through him as he thought of wielding a weapon against another person. You really think there's going to be trouble?
I have no idea, but I want to be prepared. Better safe than sorry, as they say.
Barry hung up and told Maureen that he was going to attend the anti-rally, explaining that if there was any hope of preventing violence, it would be through a show of strength, a display of numbers. He'd expected an argument, but she was defeated and resigned and said that she'd go too, that since they'd been forced into this situation and there was no way they could avoid it, they might as well face it head on. They spent the afternoon restlessly, trying to find tasks with which to occupy their minds and take up time, but the hours crept by slowly as they shifted desultorily from one unfinished household chore to another. Maureen finally ended up reading a magazine on the couch, while Barry watched Court TV and then a political talk show on CNBC. Neither of them was hungry, but they forced themselves to eat an early dinner and then wash the dishes together. They watched the local news, the national news, Entertainment Tonight, and then it was time to go. There'd been only a half hour of rain in the late afternoon, but the temperature had not returned to the high heat of midday, and the evening was unusually cool. Maureen put on a jacket, Barry changed into a long-sleeved shirt. They locked up the house and started walking. The sun had gone down only recently, and they'd been able to see from the house before they left that the western sky still carried a tinge of orange, but it was dark down here among the pines. Night arrived early on the forest floor. There were others on the road ahead of them, two couples and a family of four. Barry could see their silhouetted forms in the occasional swatches of porch light that spread out from the driveways of the dispersed houses. Neither he nor Maureen spoke, but there was a low-grade murmur audible through the trees and bushes at the bottom of the hill, the sounds of a crowd. The noise grew louder as they rounded the curve in the road. From a side street, another couple emerged, carrying flashlights trained on the pavement before them. Barry was tempted to say hello, to try and talk with them, find out if they knew anything more about what was happening than he did, but they were not people he recognized, and for all he knew, they could be association supporters. He and Maureen were walking hand in hand, and he squeezed her fingers and slowed the pace, holding back until the other couple moved far enough ahead. She understood without him having to say a word.
"You can't tell who's on which side," she said quietly after the couple pulled away.
He nodded. "It's best to be careful." The trees on the left disappeared, the land flattening out as they came to the cleared site of the communal property. The pool was done, Barry saw, and filled, the water reflecting back the blackness of the sky above. To the right of the pool, a rough wood frame and cement foundation were already in place for the community center. The volunteers had been busy. They walked quickly past the site. In horror fiction, even his own, evil was usually ascribed to locations that were old, that had troubled histories, not to places that were not even finished, that had only a future and not a past or present. But everything was bass-ackwards here, and the newly completed pool and partially constructed community center seemed imbued with malevolence and engendered within him a shivery sense of revulsion. They passed Frank and Audrey's house, past the lighted tennis courts. The street straightened out. Here was the crowd. There must have been close to 100 people milling around. Powerful halogens atop the guard shack illuminated a large section of road and gave the surrounding trees a flat, painted look, Although most of the residents had walked down, there were quite a few cars and trucks, the people who lived on the other side of the hills, no doubt. They were parked in rows in front of the gate, as though to buttress the defenses. The sheriff's cruiser was behind the kiosk by itself. It looked like a block party. People were laughing, talking, drinking beer. The only indication that anything was out of the ordinary was the strict line of demarcation, the gate, beyond which was dark, empty silence, and the fact that nearly everyone was armed. He saw no guns, other than those being examined by the sheriff and the guard inside the kiosk, but people were carrying hammers and bats and tire irons. He saw a woman with a carving knife talking to a man wielding a pool cue.
"I don't like this," Maureen whispered.
Barry didn't either. There was something unsettling about seeing ordinary people, upscale neighbors and casual acquaintances, gathered together for the purpose of fighting an opposition mob from the wrong side of the tracks. "Here they come," someone yelled. Barry looked south, over the vehicles, through the interstices of the gate. There was a line of headlights visible through the trees, snaking up the road toward Bonita Vista. He was reminded of Universal's Frankenstein films and the hoary cliché of angry villagers storming the mad scientist's castle, pitchforks and torches held aloft. There'd be no pitchforks or torches this time, though. Flashlights, maybe. Possibly guns. The crowd grew momentarily silent, as though the gravity of the situation had suddenly and simultaneously sunk in with all of them, as though they realized that there was a very realistic possibility of violence. Barry felt a knot of dread forming in the pit of his stomach. Pickups and old Chevys, boat-like Buicks and battered Jeeps began parking along the dirt shoulder abutting the ditch outside Bonita Vista, and quickly became so numerous that succeeding vehicles were forced to spread out into the middle of the street.
He looked over at Hitman standing next to the guard, the two of them loading their weapons, and he wondered again why the sheriff was so pro-Bonita Vista, why he would sacrifice the integrity of his job to do the bidding of the Homeowners Association. It didn't make any sense. He didn't even live here. Did he? The thought had never occurred to him before, and Barry was surprised at himself for overlooking so obvious a connection. Greg Davidson was a local boy made good who'd moved up into the environs of Bonita Vista. Maybe the same was true for Hitman. It would account for a lot, and he thought it was more than possible that Hitman had been lured to Bonita Vista, that the sheriff had been actively solicited by the association's board, and perhaps given a deal on financing and annual dues in order to recruit him to their side. Beyond the gate, car doors were being slammed, engines were shutting off, though no one was stepping forward. A buzz passed through the crowd of Bonita Vistans, a repeated phrase that did not quite make it to where Barry and Maureen stood. Moments later, the Corbinites started marching en masse, a ragtag group of angry ranchers, construction workers, mechanics, and business owners who appeared ready to storm the gates. Barry recognized some of the people in the crowd, Hank, Joe, Lyle, Bert. He felt sick to his stomach, but self-preservation trumped loyalty and social conscience any day of the week, and he was prepared to help fend off an assault. Mike was right. He couldn't stand idly by while his home was under attack. He just hoped there wouldn't be any injuries. Or deaths. He took Maureen's hand, squeezed it. Her fingers were cold, her body shivering. To his right was the ruddy-faced redneck who'd harassed the Mexican handyman. The fat bastard was in his element, grinning from ear to ear as he pulled a crossbow from the back of his pickup. "My old buddies," Maureen said, nodding to her left, and Barry saw Chuck Shea and Terry Abbey walking purposefully forward, swinging bats. In his mind, he'd considered the Bonita Vista people soft compared to the townies. Rich, pampered, slumming city folk as opposed to rough, tough, hard-scrabble manual laborers, but he saw now that that was an incorrect generalization. If anything, the Corbinites, despite their very visible and understandable anger, seemed awkward and amateurish, unorganized in their opposition, while the Bonita Vistans seemed prepared, methodical, and capable. Was it the association's influence? Barry thought not, and that was the frightening thing. They were this way on their own.
The sheriff and the guard aligned themselves near the stone pillars at each end of the gate, many of the more gung-ho and enthusiastic residents filling the space in between. All of a sudden, the crowd grew completely silent, individuals stopping in place, their attention drawn to someone or something in the pines behind him. Barry turned and saw a line of six old men in black robes standing at the edge of the lighted area, next to the trees. Odd gold stripes and insignia decorated the formal garb, and for some reason he thought of that jackass William Rehnquist during Bill Clinton's impeachment trial, decked out in the robes of a Supreme Court justice that were desecrated by ridiculous homemade gold stripes supposedly inspired by Gilbert and Sullivan. There was the same sort of absurdity here, only there was also an element of menace, a hint of something dark, dangerous, and fundamentally wrong. All eyes remained on the six figures. He thought the men would move forward and take charge, but they remained in place, and there was something odd about that, too. The one in the middle appeared to be the leader, and Barry had no doubt that this was the president, the famous Jasper Calhoun. Liz had told Maureen something about Calhoun's peculiar appearance, had said there was something unnatural in the way he looked, and while it could have been the angle of the lights, could have been the fault of distance, Barry thought that all of the board members seemed strange, each of their two white faces bizarre and abnormal. The townspeople had reached the gate and were massing behind the giant iron barrier. "You killed our son!" a woman screamed, her face red and teary, features distorted by rage. Another man grabbed one of the ornamental cross pieces and started shaking the gate. "Murderers!" he cried. "Murderers!" Other voices were raised, threats and epithets were shouted. "Call out the volunteers," the president said in a loud stentorian voice, and his speech overrode all competing sounds. He raised his right hand. There was the faint noise of a whip cracking, and from the trees behind the board members emerged three rows of shirtless men. The volunteers marched onto the road and pressed past Barry and Maureen, heading toward the gate. They were the same men who had been working on the pool and the community center, and this close he saw that some were missing hands. Others had serious facial scars or walked with limps. He thought of Kenny Tolkien's eye patch. Greg Davidson passed by him, staring blankly, the right side of his head shaved, that ear gone. The crowd parted before the volunteers, allowing them through. They carried no weapons, bore no clubs or guns or blades, but there was about them the hard, unyielding purpose of those who would stop at nothing to achieve their goal. They were Benita Vista's army, Barry thought, and he wondered if their appearance was as big a surprise to everyone else as it was to him. Nearly all of the residents had brought weapons of some sort, obviously assuming they would be needed, but it appeared now that they would only be a last-ditch backup. The volunteers would be the first line of defense. Barry watched them go past, far more than he and Maureen had seen before. "Why are they acting like that?" Maureen said, a quiver in her voice betraying the fear she felt. "I don't know," he admitted. "They look like they're hypnotized or something." Unseen, Frank Hodges had moved next to her. "They're indentured," he said shortly. "They couldn't pay their dues." Neil Campbell, ever-present clipboard in hand, was suddenly on the other side of Barry. "Read your handbook. It explains all about indenture." "Open the gates," the president commanded, and the twin metal doors swung slowly outward, pushing protesting townspeople out of the way. "You bastards can't treat us like this," a woman screamed. Bert from the coffee shop raised a shotgun. "You know what you did. We know what you did, and we won't stand for it." The volunteers marched through the open gateway, and the fighting started. There was a sick feeling in Barry's guts as he watched the shirtless men remorselessly punch grieving mothers in the stomach, watched them grab rifles from townspeople and use them to club the owners' heads. It felt odd to be standing here like this, overseeing the battlefield like generals while others fought on their behalf, and he was suddenly disgusted by his neighbors, by himself, by everyone involved with this travesty. Surprisingly, thankfully, there were no shots fired, but the conflict was brutal nonetheless, with both sides actively attempting to maim and injure their opponents, and his horror intensified as he saw a one-armed volunteer use his one hand to gouge at the eyes of an elderly man in rancher's overalls. He'd wondered where Hitman's deputies were, and just as the volunteers appeared to be gaining the upper hand, the lawmen drove up, sirens blaring, lights on. They were forced to park behind the townies' vehicles, which were blocking the road. The flashing lights of their cruisers reflected off metal roofs and shone through glass windshields, bathing the entire area in garishly surrealistic circus colors, while a deep, distorted voice boomed through a megaphone, "Break it up! Break it up!" Uniformed deputies ran between the cars and pickups, nightsticks raised, and began to disperse the crowd, collaring and arresting those who refused to obey the orders to cease and desist. Unmolested, undisturbed, the shirtless volunteers, many of them battered and bleeding, turned and walked back through the gateway into Bonita Vista. Barry looked over at Hitman, and in the strobing red and blue of the lights, he saw the sheriff smile. Frank had moved between Maureen and Barry. "I heard you tried to fuck my wife," he whispered. "Elizabeth Dyson's filing a complaint against you with the board," Neil Campbell said on the other side of him. "Claims you forced her into giving you a BJ after Ray's funeral." "That's a lie," Barry yelled. "You're both lying." The men moved away, laughing, disappearing into the crowd. Someone passed by, bumped him. Another shoved a hand in his back. The scene was becoming more chaotic, and though there weren't nearly as many people here, he was reminded of the climax of Day of the Locust. He looked desperately around for a friendly face, Mike or one of those anti-association people from Ray's parties, but there were only antagonistic glares from unfamiliar individuals, and the uniformity of this response made him think that perhaps it was dictated, perhaps it had been ordered. "Stay here," he told Maureen. He started toward the trees, toward the board. The robed men were watching him, their wrinkled faces serious but their eyes mirthful. It hadn't been distance or a trick of the light, he realized as he approached. Something about them did look peculiar. Liz was right. Something was off. "You must be Barry Welch," the president said as he came closer. Barry pointed a finger at him. "Don't fuck with me," he ordered. Jasper Calhoun smiled slightly, nodded. Someone bumped him, and he turned to look at the gathered residents and the milling volunteers, but he could not see who'd done it. He again faced the board. They were gone. Simultaneously, the lights of the guard shack winked off, and the strobing red and blue of the cruiser lights diminished as several deputies drove their vehicles and prisoners away. Around him, individual flashlights were turning down toward the pavement, moving up the road as homeowners started to disperse. The old men had faded into the woods, and he did not understand how they'd been able to disappear so quickly. Had they turned and run, dashing through the trees, their robes flapping behind them? He couldn't imagine such a retreat by those pompous old men, but the only alternatives were scenarios more appropriate for one of his novels, and those he didn't want to think about. "They're watching you," a woman said to him as he passed by, and Barry recognized the old lady who lived across from the tennis court. He didn't know if it was a friendly warning or an intimidating threat. Barry strode angrily back toward where Maureen stood, now talking to Mike and Tina. The people before him moved sullenly aside, strangers casting suspicious and hostile glances in his direction. "Is everything okay?" Mike asked worriedly. Barry shook his head. "What did you do?" Maureen asked. "What did you say to them?" "It's war," he told her. 36. Maureen finished answering the 5 measly emails that her webpage had generated over the past 3 days, knowing even as she typed them that their senders would not engage her services. It was disheartening to realize that something on which she had spent so much time and for which she'd had such high hopes was simply not panning out. Thank God for her California clients. She leaned back in her chair, postponing leaving the room. In here, she was cushioned from the realities of the outside world. She could pretend that she was not in Bonita Vista, that she was merely an accountant in an office, and that the things happening on the other side of these walls did not affect or concern her in any way.
Barry was still angry, still stubbornly defiant, but he was worried as well. Maybe it was time to give up, she'd told him. Maybe they should return to California. That was the wrong thing to say. Who's going to fight them if not us? He demanded. Would you just abandon Liz and all the other people terrorized by these murderous bastards? We're not just doing this for us. This is our chance to make a difference, to stand up and be counted. She nodded, raised her hands in acquiescence. She knew better than to press the issue and paint him into a corner. If she left him an out, he might eventually take it, might eventually see that it was the smartest of all possible options, and that they could always continue their quixotic battle from afar. She shut off her computer, switched off the monitor. The strangest thing, the most unsettling thing, was their temporary alliance with the Association. It felt wrong to her. And to Barry, too, she knew. The Association had poisoned dogs in town, and intentionally or unintentionally, two children had been killed as well. The sheriff had refused to do anything about it, so families, friends, and neighbors had taken matters into their own hands and staged a rally to draw attention to the problem and intimidate the guilty into giving themselves up. It was a just cause, a moral purpose, and she and Barry and all of their neighbors had only opposed it because they were concerned for their own safety and for the condition of their houses. They were practicing self-defense, went the rationalization, the most natural and legitimate reaction a human could have. But it did not feel that way to her. It felt as though they were shallow, self-absorbed assholes more concerned about their own real estate values than the lives of other people's children. She and Barry had participated unwillingly, as a result of a threat, but they had participated nonetheless, and that made them morally culpable. She felt guilty about that, and she wished to Christ that they'd defied the Association, that they'd at least attempted to stay neutral by remaining home and sitting it out, even if they'd had to pay a fine. They should not have lent their support or given their tacit approval to anything the Association had done. To her surprise, they were still able to shop at the market in Corbin, even after all that had happened. It had been a nerve-wracking trip for groceries yesterday when they'd made their first post-rally trek into town, and they'd invited Mike and Tina, and the Stewart's friends Lou and Stacy, to go with them in case there was trouble, but neither the clerk at the checkout stand nor the store's two other customers had said a word. They'd bought enough groceries for the next 2 weeks with no problem. Perhaps the sheriff's deputy stationed by the cash register had something to do with it, even if it was only Wally Addison. They were already making contingency plans, though. Mule Park was the closest town to Corbin, and while it was 40 miles to the south, they could easily make the trip there and back in the space of a morning and stock up enough food and necessities for a month. The people of Corbin had to be resentful of Bonita Vista residents and of the sheriff's obvious partiality, and it was only a matter of time before that resentment bubbled up and boiled over. She stared at the blank monitor and found herself wondering if she and Barry weren't barking up the wrong tree by attributing everything to the Homeowners Association. It seemed to her that Hitman was the real power behind the throne. He was the one straddling the two communities, enforcing the laws as he saw fit, allowing Bonita Vista to run roughshod over the town. He could have, and should have, sided with the families of the victims and investigated the poisonings and brought the perpetrators up on charges, but instead, he'd ignored the situation, allowed it to fester, and when people had tried to take the law into their own hands, he'd reasserted his authority, allowing them to be beaten by the volunteers before he had them arrested. Now he'd stationed a deputy at the market to ensure that Bonita Vistans could purchase groceries and assigned another deputy to guard the gas station and make sure they were unmolested and able to buy gas. It was as if the sheriff had declared martial law in Corbin, and it occurred to her that he could have accomplished all of this without the Association. That was wishful thinking, though. The sheriff was just a pawn. He was the muscle. The Association was the brains. No, he was not even the muscle. Or not all of it. She remembered those shirtless volunteers with their missing fingers and hands and ears beating the hell out of local farmers and ranchers, using the Corbinites' own weapons against them, and she shivered. Hitman might be keeping Corbin safe for Bonita Vista residents, but Barry had not returned to his office. Not yet. For all they knew, it had been ransacked and vandalized, his computer smashed, but he was not ready to see for himself. His landlord and his old pals from the coffee shop had been in the forefront of the skirmish at the gate, and it did not seem prudent to provoke them. He'd write on her computer for a while, Barry told her. He'd go back, pick up his equipment, and clear out his office after the furor died down a bit. Mike was still working at the Cablevision office, and his friend Lou at the telephone company, but it was tense, they said. Several Bonita Vistans worked in town, and Maureen wondered how the rest of them were handling it. No doubt there'd be more than a few fights during breaks and lunches as tensions spilled over, and she just prayed that no one got seriously hurt. She looked out the window, saw green pines against a clear blue sky. God, she wished that they'd never driven through Utah, never found this place. She stood, left her office, and walked upstairs to where Barry was lying on the couch watching a political talk show. On the coffee table beside him was the pen he'd planned to use to jot down notes for a new novel, and a spiral notebook turned to an empty first page. "Doesn't look like you got much done," she said. "My brain's not working." "I'm not working either. No one wants my e-services. Want to sit here with me and watch some BVTV? "Very funny," Barry said. "Very funny." They went to bed early, both of them tired and fatigued, not from any physical exertion, but from stress. They were awakened in the middle of the night by banging, thumping, and heavy scraping that sounded as though furniture was being moved. The bedroom door was closed, but from underneath the door shone a strip of yellow light. Someone was upstairs. Maureen sat up quickly, looking into Barry's face and seeing there an expression that mirrored the way she felt. "What do you think they want?" she whispered. "Who do you think it is?" was what she'd originally intended to ask. But she already knew the answer to that, and so did he. These weren't burglars who had broken into their home. And while she didn't know the specific identity of the individuals who were searching the house, she knew what they represented. She knew where they were from. The Homeowners Association. "I'm going to find out," Barry said grimly. He threw the covers off, grabbed his bathrobe, and angrily opened the bedroom door. She quickly picked up her own bathrobe and put it on over her nightgown, and the two of them walked into the lighted hallway and up the stairs to the living room. They should have brought along some type of weapon, she thought. A heavy, blunt object, just in case it was a prowler. But their first instincts had been correct. The man who stood in the center of the well-lit room, smiling at them, was obviously not a criminal. He looked more like a stockbroker. "Sorry to disturb you," the man said cheerfully. "We were trying to be quiet." There were five men altogether, each of them dressed in identical business suits, each with a pen and clipboard. Two of them were in the living room, reading the titles of books on the bookshelf, examining the artwork on the walls. The three others were upstairs in the kitchen, loudly opening cupboards and digging through drawers. "What the hell is this?" Barry said. "It's time for your 4 months inspection." "How did you get in here?" Maureen demanded. She felt vulnerable, violated, more exposed than she ever had in her life. Upstairs, a familiar click-squeak told her that someone had opened the refrigerator. "The association has the master keys to all locks in Bonita Vista." The man continued to smile at her, and she thought now that there was something not nice about that smile. He was looking at her as though he could see through her bathrobe, and she instinctively looked down to check, to make sure nothing was being exposed. Barry stepped forward, crowding the man. "Who are you?" "My name's Bill." He held out a hand. Barry's voice was calm, even, and all the more threatening for it. "Get the fuck out of my house, Bill, now." The man smiled, nodded. "I think we've seen enough, Mr. Welch." He started scribbling on the paper clipped onto his board. "Let's hit it, boys," he called out. The three men upstairs came down the steps, writing on their own clipboards, unclasping the forms and handing them to Bill. The other man by the bookcase did the same. Bill finished with a flourish, tore off the top sheet, and handed a pink piece of paper to Barry. Maureen looked over his shoulder, reading along. "It should be self-explanatory. You are required to place out of sight all photographs and personal keepsakes.
This includes, but is not limited to, souvenirs from vacation spots, family heirlooms, and knickknacks that serve no functional purpose. Bill's voice was all business, and there was a coldness to it that belied the happy, hearty act he'd put on for their benefit. Behind him, the other men were filing out of the house silently. You must have a minimum of 3 bare walls in each room, and the 4th wall may only have artwork that has been approved by the association's interior design committee. All walls must be white or off-white, and sheets, pillowcases, and bedspreads must be solid colors, preferably earth tones. He smiled again. But as I said, it's all pretty self-explanatory. Maureen now understood the lack of a personal touch in Liz's house, the general sparseness in the interiors of the other homes she'd seen. She could not recall reading anything about this in the sacred CC&Rs, but she had no doubt that they would find it in the document if they looked through it right now. She stared at the short-haired yuppie's falsely friendly face and was filled with anger and the type of stubborn rage that Barry must have been experiencing. There was no way on God's earth that she was going to rearrange her house according to the dictates of the association. No one could tell her how to decorate her own home, and she'd be damned if an impersonal document created by a cabal of her most fascistic neighbors was going to impose some type of lunatic standards on her taste. Barry was on the exact same wavelength. What gives you the right to come into our house and pry into our private life and tell us what we can and can't do in our own fucking home? He started out speaking at a normal volume, but by the end of the question he was shouting. I'm chairman of the inspection committee, Bill said brightly, walking away from them. He nodded as he stepped out the door. Good night to you. He closed the door behind him, and they heard the lock turn. Didn't we have the deadbolt and chain hooked up? Maureen said, turning toward Barry. He nodded. I was thinking the same thing. How did they? I don't know. Every light in the house had been turned on. Downstairs, lights in the hall, bathroom, and Maureen's office were blazing, and the thought that those men had been snooping through her belongings while she was asleep in the next room chilled her to the bone.